There you go. I was talking to myself. Salaamu alaikum, Maheen. Nice to see you.
Walaikum salam, Sheikh.
Folks, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm going to start. This is, as you know, the next iteration of what we thought we could do on a monthly basis. It's really my intention is to keep this sort of open, make it conversational. But there were questions that were put to me. There were five questions put to me on the WhatsApp group prior to this. So I thought I could deal with those first, and then any matters arising we could deal with subsequently. So I've put the questions on a deck. We won't be talking to the slide, but I'll just give you each question as they come up, and then we'll stop the share and I'll just explore the questions. So the first questions, and as you can see, these are related questions. I've wondered about one's openness to receive, and what part of us does the receiving. Whether it is feedback, reflections in the mirror, acts of kindness towards us, how does that feature on the path of maturation? While we are able to practice giving unconditionally, is there a parallel intention to be willing to receive? I would be interested in understanding the role of vulnerability. So the second question was, I would be interested in understanding the role of vulnerability as a human condition on the path. And for me, these are basically two very consistent themes. The whole issue of vulnerability and the whole issue of and how that relates to receiving. It's very important. When one speaks about giving unconditionally, that one doesn't understand this as almost like a maniacal sort of ascetic worldview that says I'm not going to ask for anything, I'm not going to get anything, because that really isn't what we're suggesting. I mean, that giving unconditionally means that in any situation that you're in, you can either construct your engagement with the situation on one of two variables. You can either construct your engagement with the situation and what you can give, or you can construct your engagement with the situation and what you receive. Now, I beg your pardon, what you get, not what you receive. I beg your pardon. You can either base your intent on what you do, what you're giving, or you can base your intent on what you're trying to get. Basing your intent on what you're trying to get actually is about taking. Now, the question is there a difference between taking and receiving? And yes, there is, because the difference between taking and receiving means that you leave agency with the other. As soon as I treat somebody, the other, as a resource that I can do something to with the intent to produce an outcome, that's what we call taking. Now, people are programmed to resist that. If you engage somebody else brazenly to get something from them without them even thinking about it rationally, they will resist you. If you engage somebody with a ruse of being nice or being sweet, with the intent to get something out of them, this is two injuries. Not only are you trying to get something out of them, but you're treating like an idiot in the process. So actually, the reaction that you solicit is even worse. Yeah. If you, it's bad enough somebody trying to get something out of you, but if they're treating you like a fool, then you will take them on to take them out. Which says to us that our engagement to the other with the intent to manage outcomes, with the intent to get something from the other, is deeply problematic, because it reduces the other to a means to our ends. Now, How does one shift this? You understand that whatever comes to you is not within your power. Whatever comes to you is in the power of the other. This is what vulnerability is about. And peculiarly, this kind of vulnerability makes you immensely powerful because it releases you to give attention to what you have power over. And what you have power over is not on what you're getting, but over what leaves you, over what you're giving. So the trick of cultivating this kind of vulnerability that opens you up to being able to receive is is gratitude. I mean, just think about it. If you give something to somebody else, and that person snatches the thing that you're giving from, or sort of exudes some sort of sense that, you know, you owe me this. I was entitled to the thing that you gave me. Then the very last thing you want to give that person is something else. You know, that person has just changed your giving from one day of you having given to something being taken from you. Which means to say that if the person does not reflect the appropriate gratitude for your generosity, then you it disables your generosity. It stops your wanting to give to them. So if you want to create the conditions where you stay on the station of being appropriate, but at the same time you open yourself to what the other is giving to you, you receive rather than take. Practice gratitude. Be grateful. When you are grateful, you are affirming to the other that you are not entitled to what the other is giving to you. You see, folks, we're deeply vulnerable on the basis of what we're trying to get. When you construct your in, when you when you when you when you engage, when you allow whatever comes to you to be left in the agency of the other, allow them to give it to you by staying grateful, you are celebrating that vulnerability. That is the vulnerability of being a human. If you just think about it, in any situation that you're in, anything that comes to you from other than you is in the power of other than you. It is not in your own power, which means to say we are all vulnerable. And further to this, it is not possible to not receive, because if you stop receiving, you die. If you stop receiving nutrients, if you stop receiving air, if you stop, you are completely delivered to the power of other than you on the basis of your good or your personal good auspices, whatever you need, whatever you require from the world. Being vulnerable means that you recognize that you recognize that you are powerless to act in your own interests, that the only power you have over is over what leaves you, over what you're giving, rather than what you're getting. You know, the work that I do looks mainly at organization, and more often than not, looks at the role of leaders in organizations. Now, so metaphorically, how does one, how can you explore this issue of vulnerability and how that relates to power? And actually that your power is based on your vulnerability. Let's assume we've got two kinds of bosses. There's a boss that you would work for because you have to, and a boss that you'll work for because you want to. The question is, which one of those two bosses got power? Who's genuinely powerful? And clearly it is the boss that you will work for because you want to is genuinely powerful. And the reason why that person is genuinely powerful is that you are loyal to that person. That person has your willing alliance. You are on that person's side. A leader, any person who doesn't have the willing alliance of the people around them, is not powerful. They are actually extremely weak. They're assailable. Now, why does this power? So, what is this boss saying? What is the boss recognizing when this boss is somebody that you'd work for because you want to? Is that they recognize that they don't actually own the power. Their power is based on your loyalty to them. The other way of looking at this relationship that you can have with the subordinate is that you create conditions where people work for you because they have to. In other words, they don't experience that they want to give you anything. They experience that anything that that leaves them for you gets taken from them. They have to do it, not they want to do it. When somebody works for you because they have to work for you, basically, you're engaging them in such a way to compel, either by ruse, by being sweet, or by force. You're trying to compel out of them what you want. You're not leaving your good auspices in their hands. You're trying to force agency. You're trying to make sure you get out of them what you want. So there's a fundamental difference between power, the power and the intent to control. Power is based on the acknowledgement of your vulnerability. It is based on the insight that actually that the other has power over your good auspices, that whatever comes from other to you cannot take it. You don't take it, you receive it. And when you have that attitude, peculiarly, you receive more because it's pleasurable for the other to give to you. Whereas if you're trying to guarantee outcomes, get what you want, then make sure you get out of them what you want. That intent to control produces the condition where the other becomes vulnerable to you. I'm sorry, becomes a bigger problem. The other becomes hostile to you, and they withhold what you want. The further thing to this is that this does not suggest that you are never permitted to voice vulnerability. Can you ask somebody for something? I'm desperate for a glass of water. Please, can you give me a glass of water? That doesn't disable your agency. You can still choose not to give me the water, or you can pour the water, give it to me, and if I then indicated appropriately, thank you very much, I've confirmed your agency, because by saying thank you very much, I recognize that I did not have the right to the water. That this was you have given me in that sense in excess of my due. Thank you. You've given me. I didn't have a right to this. Constructing your intent on the basis of what you being here to give does not mean to say that you don't receive anything, and it doesn't mean to say that you don't admit vulnerability or need, but you admit it in such a way that you leave agency for what you require with the other, and you celebrate the fact that you've left agency with the other by indicating gratitude when they give to you what you ask them for. All of this that we're describing now is actually, it's a cartoon. Because what we're describing is your engagement with other people and how this patterning of transaction and interaction works between the self and the other. All of that is a cartoon, is a miniature of our engagement with Allah. We have two engagements with other than ourselves. The first is with a social other, with other people, and that's where we learn these basic rules of engagement. Of learning to engage the other on the basis of contributing and allowing the other to give to you. That engagement is the small school, it's the baby school of the real engagement, which is your engagement with anything, the totality of the other, because the totality of the other is the face of Allah. And exactly the same rules work. When you treat the world that Allah puts in front of you as a resource that you dominate to get what you want, you not only destroy that world, but actually you create a world that's deeply hostile to you. But when you create the conditions and when you deal with the world by foregoing the outcome, and by the way, the most profound way of foregoing outcome is dua. Because when you're making a dua, you are handing the problem to the boss. I can't do this. Please, you know, you're allowing yourself to receive rather than take. So it is very strange that when we forego the management of the affair, that when we forego trying to control the outcomes that we're trying to produce from our lives, that we receive more. Because we don't need to take. Because the world that we're in lives up to the first truth that we professed even before we came into being. You know, that he is our Rabb. Who's your Rabb? What is the Rabb? The Rabb is your benefactor and your protector, your ally. The one who gives and the one who withholds. Ar-Rahman Ar-Rahim. Thank you very much. That was that first question, folks. Maybe I should go through all the questions and then we'll kind of, if there's still any kind of after that, then we'll pursue that. So that was the question. I'm just going to read it again to make sure that I did sort of answer it. I think I did. I've wondered about one's openness to receive and what part of us does the receiving, whether it is feedback or reflections in the mirror, acts of kindness towards us. How does that feature on the path of maturation while we are able to practice giving unconditionally? Is there a parallel intention to be willing to receive? And yes, exactly that. Exactly that. There is a parallel intention to be willing to receive. I would be interested in understanding the role of vulnerability as a human condition on the path. These are very consistent concerns. So the next question is, can traveling and not being tied to the capitalist structure in some way remove a sense of grasping that hinders inner spirituality? We are taught to be vulnerable in this society. Wanting makes us vulnerable. But we're actually, I'm assuming you're speaking about me. This is a question that was represented through somebody else. So you talk so much about stepping away from that instead of putting one's trust in Allah. Because your vulnerabilities are usually related to some sort of need for accolade, love, or whatever it might be. So I don't know that I entirely understand the question. So I'm just going to speak to a direction that I think the question is aiming at, and I might miss it completely. And if I do, the person who asked this question is on the call. Please clarify it for me. It is not without reason that suluk is wayfaring, that being on the path is wayfaring. It's also not sort of accidental that people of the fuqara are described as the strangers, the unknown ones, the insignificant ones, the ones who sit sort of under a dusty burqa or in a dusty under a dusty burnous in the corner, kind of unnoticed and unpretentious and just dismissed, if you like. It is cultivating that way of looking at things, that you are fundamentally beholden to Allah, that you cannot manage things in your interest, that produces this element of strangeness. Because most people, this way of looking at things is very bizarre for most people. We are generally of the view that people, people are here to get something. You know, everybody's here to get something. I mean, you kind of, I had a conversation with somebody in Kenya about a week ago where I was, it was very sweet. I mean, I was very passionate about constructing your intent on the basis of the intent to give. And his feedback to me afterwards was, yeah, but that's naive. I mean, it's just true. He said, you know, nobody's just here to give. We all had to get something. And what the person had obviously missed in this matter was the issue of gratitude and the centrality of gratitude, that it is possible for your intent to structure in such a way that it's not an emptiness that seeks to be filled, but that's a fullness that empties, you know. Which means to say that a person who's pursuing this way of being, which is about constantly foregoing outcomes and foregoing what you want to get from your life, to stay, to keep your attention on what you're contributing and allowing the world to give to you, that person becomes, from one point of view, really strange and inscrutable. I mean, there's nobody who's more, you know, if you work out what somebody wants from you, you've got them nailed. They become completely definable. They become scrutable. They become, you can, this is who you are because I know what you want, you know. But if somebody doesn't behave like that and they're not trying to get anything out of you, they kind of, they are quite disturbing. They become quite inscrutable. So our journey is the journey of becoming the inscrutable ones, the wayfarers, the ones who are passing through. We don't want anything from this place. We're passing through. Now, it's just also very interesting. This person said that our vulnerabilities are usually concerned with some sort of need for an accolade or love. So that's the second thing. The being comfortable with inscrutability, being comfortable so there's two things we can want from the other. The first is material stuff, and the second is significance. These two needs are layered on top of each other, and it's basically been part of our socialization process. When we, you know, as a child, as a toddler, I mean, the most important thing is getting what's going to satisfy you now. You know, the relief of the pain, the something to eat or whatever. I mean, as a middle child, you recognize that the other people have the power to withhold that stuff from you, and that you actually have to be nice to them to get out of them what you want. So this sort of just demand, give me what I want now, gets replaced by something more nuanced, which is saying if I get them to find me significant, if I get them to like me, if I get their good opinion of me, then I can get out of them what I want. So this need for significance from other is a secondary development on the primary need, which is just the need for stuff. And it's something that we get socialized into. Of these two, we are far more assailable, far weaker. I'm going to use the word vulnerable, but I don't want to abuse the word based on what we just said before. But we are more vulnerable on the basis of our desire for significance than what we are on the basis of our desire for things. Because if I want something from you, let's assume I want your, whatever you have a telephone near you, most people today have a, I want your phone, your ability to withhold the phone gives you power over me, you can manipulate me. But if I want something else, if I want you to like me, I want something I can never actually get in my hand like the phone, which means I'm far more vulnerable, I'm far more manipulable is the right word. I'm manipulable on the basis of, I'm much more manipulable on the basis of my desire for significance than what I am on the basis of my desire for things, which means taking on the psychology, the way of being of the wayfarer, who's here for a short period of time, who may or may not be remembered tomorrow because I'm passing through this life. I'm the wayfarer. That makes that is an immense freedom to it. And you know, I mean, there's a paradox in all of this. And that is, give the thing that you want. As a wayfarer, you are recognizing the significance of what you are passing through. You're not demanding significance from it. Now, just think about this. Who do you find more pleasurable to be with? The person who's constantly trying to bring to your attention how significant they are, or the person who finds you genuinely interesting? And it's clearly the latter. So, strangely, the thing that we want, the accolade, the love, the high regard, the significance we get from, it is not ours to take, to get. But we can receive it if we forego it and give it unconditionally in any situation. And it's not a trade. It's not, well, you be nice to me, then I'll be nice to you tomorrow. It's not like that. Or I'll be nice to you so that you can be nice to me tomorrow. It is genuinely, in any situation that you're in, understand that what you're looking at is truly significant. It is so significant that your significance in the matter pales into unimportance. And when you have that attitude, you find amazingly people have a very high regard for you. So become the stranger, become the wayfarer, and you, strangely enough, then you are the known one. You are the loved one, and you come home. Alhamdulillah. I left a question. The next question is, I'm seeking advice on how to manage the space a petty tyrant takes up in my head. It seems as I reach a place where I trick myself in thinking I've moved past the rub because of this caused by this character, and then a small or a big thing occurs and I'm right back swimming in it. This is also related to the next question, which I'm going to read to you. But it's basically, how do I deal with the difficult or unpleasant kind of experience? My question relates to others, to what other men say. I'd like to hear a bit more once again about how to keep the centrality of this existence on the remembrance of Allah, so that worldly issues, in other words, the petty tyrant or worries about things, don't take over our mind. I'm aware of the immense miraculous value of Islamic rituals of Salah, Dhikr, Quran, but I'm eager to know how to bring the awareness in those intense and immediate moments. In other words, confrontations, hidden tragedies, your favorite petty tyrant sort of getting under your skin, people backbiting, how to keep the heart steady and grounded and steadfast. What would help the mind not to deviate? Wow. Okay, so I'm going to take that away so I can look at you. I honestly think that our path is two steps forward and one step back. And that you've only learned the lesson when you stop needing the lesson. In other words, the person will continue to annoy you for as long as you need them to annoy you. And we've spoken about this before. How do you propose to transcend your own conditional motive if the world keeps on presenting you with conditions which suit you? I mean, that helps nothing at all. It is precisely because I'm confronted by conditions that don't suit me, that rub me up the wrong way, that gives me the information that I need to suggest, hold on, there's still something going on the inside. Now, that's cold comfort for somebody, and even myself, when you're confronted with somebody who's driving you to distraction, when you can just imagine what you could do to them in the small hours of the morning when nobody's looking. I think even the most profoundly developed people still on occasion have that feeling. Man, if I could get hold of you in the small hours of the morning, I feel sorry for you. We all have this, but what happens, my experience of this is that it really is like the rising, it's like Nordic dawn. What I mean by this is, if you're in the tropics, you're near to the tropics, the difference between light and dark is like that. I mean, you today, and particularly, if you're on the equator, the Maghrib is a very short period. I mean, now it's light, and the sun's now it's dark. Somebody throws a switch. It's like Allah throws a switch, and it's dark. In Nordic climes, that the dusk is a very long period. It's a slow burn, a slow move through all the phases of gray until it's light. And I really think that we need to understand these things that throw us off balance in this light. I mean, if you think, cast your mind back to maybe when you were an adolescent and about something that might have completely wound you up, and ask yourself, does it still wind you up today? Probably not, you know? So at some point, you did manage to transcend the thing. It lost its grip over you. And you say, that very rarely happened like a switch. It was probably many iterations over a period of time where you just finally gave up on the matter. And said, that's silly. I'm not going to make that important to me anymore. So what this suggests for me is that as we grow spiritually, we will get thrown off. We will get knocked off balance. You will, even if you're doing everything that you think is going to be helpful to you, very sort of consistent with your salah, you're very consistent with your dhikr, you do all the right things, you journal, you kiss babies, you're kind and sweet, you're such a good person, you do it all. And still, there's somebody who drives you to this, man, if I could get a hold of you. But those periods will get shorter and shorter. Because what does happen with your practice is that you are practicing, I mean, think of the dawn in a Nordic country as an incremental growth of light. Every time you practice, it is like the sun coming up a little bit more, a little greater increment of light. So just the moment you realize you've been distracted, the moment you come back, and maybe in the process of coming back, you get distracted. I mean, how many times have we had it that you're halfway through the salah and this monster kind of appears, you know, and you half the salah is you trying to wrestle them out of your consciousness so you can finish your salah. It's going to happen. But what happens is that with our practice, we incrementally get better and better and better at dealing with these things. To think that there's a magic bullet that says, from today, I take this pill and I'm unassailable, is nuts. This journey is called a path for a reason. It is incremental move to arrival. It isn't a switch. You know? All right, folks. I think that is what I wanted to say. in response to those questions, I'll look in the chat. Maybe there are more questions there. Right. Okay. Okay. So, is that good enough? Should we canon? Does anybody else want to ask anything?
Assalamu alaikum. I have a question.
Please.
So I've been wondering that the path that we want to take less from the world and give more sounds great to the heart. The challenge comes when sometimes it's more collective than individualistic, for example, to just, and not only in terms of things, but experiences, for example, having lavish meals or meeting people to get something out of them. Indulging more in the worldly things that sometimes can feel like burdens to the soul. There are sometimes collective experiences with those who are very, very close to us. Wanting to refrain from that or trying to disconnect a little bit from that can sometimes strain relationships with the ones who are close to us. How does one navigate through that?
So I just want to prefix what I'm going to say. Maybe I should just summarize what I've heard you say, Mary, just to make sure I understand. Because there's really two issues. The one is how it doesn't feel entirely practical. I'm paraphrasing. It doesn't feel entirely practical to construct my engagement with the world on what I'm giving and not to take anything. And the second question is, how do I deal with people around me who actually have a requirement of me to take?
Yes,
Is that
yes.
right? Are they two separate questions?
I
Or
think
is
more
it
the second than the first
more?
one.
Okay. All right. Well, I if you can, the difference between taking something and receiving something is not in the thing. So somebody produces a really lavish meal for me. I can deal with this experience of you putting this feast on the table from the point of view, yeah, it's fine, but you really did owe me this. And by the way, there's not enough salt in the stew. It's sort of as that's the one. And or I demand this, or thank you very much, I wasn't expecting so much at all. And then to eat whatever you need, and to if you if I can, this is as much as I can. I beg your pardon. I can't eat anymore. I mean, it's very simple. So the point I'm trying to make is the difference between taking something and receiving it is not in the thing. It is in your attitude towards the thing. So for instance, if there's a big family gathering, and I mean, it is a requirement for you to be there. You can still choose to view this thing through the lens of, well, I mean, this is all about duty and obligation. Either they owe me or I owe them, or I receive. That has nothing to do with the event. It's got everything to do with how you frame your reaction in your own mind. Because obligation and entitlement, in a sense, mirror problems. So obligation is I owe other, entitlement is other owes me. They're all about what I should. What it's all about this sort of this demand for reciprocity and kind of good behavior. Yeah. So I don't think you can be in the same gathering, same meeting, and not be playing the game of good behavior. Now, that doesn't mean to say that I think that you have license to behave badly. I just you can be there without responding to your feeling that it's an obligation to be there. You can make it a choice for yourself so that you can receive whatever is there. At the same time, I mean, Miriam, this also relates to the other question, which is our need for significance from people. If there's, I mean, if you really do find something burdensome and tedious, and you're only doing the thing out of a feeling of obligation to people around you, let's say, for instance, there's your least favorite cousin's getting married. And it's one of these interminable marriages, carry on for life. And you're going to be sitting at a table and getting, I don't know, varicose veins from sitting still, and you really can't face it, then I think don't go. And if it upsets them, I mean, you really do feel that you can do something better with that half day than sitting in this ex enormously exhausting experience. So I don't think we're obliged to always obliged to do what others want of us. Giving means doing what is appropriate, and sometimes what people want from us is not appropriate. I don't know if that's been helpful, Miriam.
No, it has been immensely. Thank you so much,
Thank
Azakia.
you. Thank you. Let me see if there's anything on the chat here. Mahbub Saab, I hope it wasn't soup that I gave you because I do make very salty food. So Mahbub says, if someone dear to you gives you soup that tastes too salty and then they smile and ask you how it tastes, how do you manage gratitude, giving insignificance, honesty in the situation? You learn to enjoy salt. I mean, you could say, look, it's a bit salty for me, but I like this or I like that or whatever. Bear in mind that I might not necessarily like the taste of something, but I certainly appreciate the generosity that sat behind putting the thing in front of me. Those are two different things. I see that you've done something, you've gone out of your way, you've put this thing in front of me. That's not entirely how I like it, but I recognize the effort that's gone into this. I recognize that if I would have done the same thing, it would have taken me this. None of that I did myself. That was all done for me. So thank you very much. You gave me a bowl of soup. My personal preference is something not quite so salty, but let me give it a whirl. Let me see if I can learn to like this. But in a sense, Mahbub, you're asking the wrong person because I like food so much, I'll eat anything you put in front of me. As long as it doesn't squeal when I bite. So, Atia, how do you handle your relationship with a boss you don't want to work for, considering you don't have any other option in the foreseeable future? So, Atia, I'm going to repeat something that other people will be familiar with. So, people who have heard this, close your ears or this is where the idea of the petty tyrant comes from. And I'll repeat the sort of two datum points that we kind of use to understand the petty tyrant. The first datum point is a story from Sheikh Muhammad Ibn al-Habib, who was once approached by a murid who was complaining about his wife. The murid was complaining about his wife. And the murid said, Sheikh, this woman I'm married to is such a cow. I mean, you cannot believe. I had friends came to visit last week and she chased them out the house. I mean, she chased them out. And last night my mother came to visit and she deliberately burnt the food. And then she did this, and then she did that, and then she. So the guy was carrying on for a while, and then finally Sheikh got annoyed and he said, look, shut up. And the man said, well, why? And the Sheikh said, you clearly don't understand the purpose of a spouse. He said, the relationship between a person and their spouse is like the relationship between water and a vessel. It is the nature of the water to find where the cracks in the vessel are. It is poor courtesy of the vessel to complain when the water finds the cracks. So it's a beautiful story that says to us that we are only vulnerable where our cracks are, where our own conditional motive is. The things we're trying to manage from the world to suit us, those things that we want to get, that we're trying to take, that's where we are. And how do we find out what those things are if we're only going to be in situations that suit us? So impossible people in authority over us, are the most unbelievably useful tools on this journey. You cannot find a better one. In fact, the word petty tyrant actually, it's not my invention. It comes from the work of Carlos Castaneda, who studied under this or was an apprentice, was a an apprentice shaman with this teacher called Don Juan. And Don Juan taught out of the context of a tradition that they call Toltec. And he said the old Toltec shamans used to view a petty tyrant. In other words, as somebody, they define a petty tyrant as follows. Somebody who is completely irascible, completely frightening, the most horrible being that has absolute authority over you. And the more irascible, the more difficult they are, the better. There's nothing that tempers the soul of an aspirant more than being subordinate to to a person in a position of authority who's got just about total prerogative over you. It's the most constructive thing you can do if what what you're trying to do is work on the inside, work on this side of your experience. A person like that offers you the best gymnasium. I mean, the muscles you're trying to develop are inner muscles, right? And if I put you in the gym and I wanted you to sort of develop some outer muscles, then I wouldn't put you on on apparatus that's easy. That's not going to strengthen anything. I put you on apparatus which is just at the limit of what you can tolerate, because you push into that, you grunt into that, you work with that. Now you're developing muscle. It's exactly the same for inner work. If you're in a world which just confirms you and is easy, you learn nothing. You don't grow. The more irascible the people around you are, the more problematic, the more challenging the context is, the better it is for your inner growth. This boss of yours, may I say, Atia, is an angel. Take the person a bunch of roses, kiss them on both cheeks, and say, "Thank you for being the monster in my life." All right, folks, it looks like we're done. Yes. Beautiful seeing you all again. Thank you for so many people coming from all over the world. That's all from me. If anybody would like to kind of say anything, or just kind of by way of greeting or whatever, I'll keep it open for a moment.
Jacob?
Yes, Fatima.
So I just a follow-up kind of question to what you have just said about the petty tyrant, especially in Atiya's case, the boss. I mean, the other option could be that we just quit the job. But as I understand, you're saying that it would mean that you don't grow then, because that is an opportunity to learn. But the option, so does one actually just stay in a situation that's very torturous to learn? I mean, what would be the extent of that torture that one bears before, calling it quits?
You don't have to go to work on the most difficult pieces of equipment in the gym. But that's if you have the if you can move, you can, because there's another thing. I mean, it's from Quran that Allah didn't if you're being oppressed in a land, migrate. That is true. What is the land? The organization. If you're being oppressed, migrate. It's your right to do so. But what Atia described here is, how do you handle a relationship with a boss that you don't want to, considering that you don't have any other option in the foreseeable future? If that's the case, if you really are stuck, because sometimes you can't migrate. I mean, that is true. That's also recognized in Quran. Sometimes you can't migrate. Then I'm afraid the best way of doing it is saying, well, how can I make the sort of get the maximum ju juice out of this lemon?
Thank you.
Assalamualaikum,
Thank
Sheikh
you.
Saab. It's
Walaikum
so
salam.
wonderful to see you.
Thank you
And
very
thank you so
much.
much for today.
Pleasure. Thank you. Nice to see you too. All the best. Alhamdulillah.
Thank
Thank
you.
Thank
Salaam
you. Thank you.
alaikum.
Thank you so
Walaikum
much, Sheikh
assalam.
Saab.
Fiamanallah.
Kareem.
Walaikum assalam. Thank you, Sheikh.
Alaikum. Thank you,
Alaikum
Sheikh.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sheikh Saab. Assalamu
Alaikum. All the best.
alaikum. Thank you so
Thank
much,
you.
Jazakallah, for all the
Thank you, Atia.
answers.
Thank you. I'll
Thank you,
send.
Sheikh Saab.
Thank you very much. How are you doing, ma'am? Zainab.
Good. Alhamdulillah. Very well. Very well.
Looking well, alhamdulillah.
Thank you.
All
You too.
right. Thank you. All the best. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.